Welcome to MLM After Hours on Building Fortunes Radio. You can listen in live to MLM After Hours on the 1st, 3rd, and 5th Monday, if there is one, of every month. Or listen anytime in the future by selecting the MLM After Hours broadcast segments on www.buildingfortunesradio.com. Building Fortunes Radio supports our members and everyone looking for their personal level of success in the home-based business industry. Your host for Building Fortunes Radio is Peter Mingle, owner of PM Marketing and Network Lead. On this segment of Building Fortunes Radio, Peter will be introducing you to the MLM After Hours. MLM After Hours is also sponsored by Doris Wood and the MLMIA. The Multi-Level Marketing International Association has been serving the industry for over 28 years, and you can join us on the MLMIA segment every Monday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. The MLM industry has always been confusing and controversial in some areas concerning policies, procedures, rules, regulations, and compliance issues. MLM After Hours will be joined by guest hosts that are familiar with these controversial subjects. Dr. Keith Lego, Len Clemens, Mel Atwood, Doris Wood, and other MLM After Hours guests have had their share of experiences and will share their views with us now. So how about it? Let's get this show started. Here's Peter.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to Building Fortunes Radio, and Monday night on the 1st, the 3rd, and if there's a 5th Monday, we do our MLM After Hours radio show. And I can share with you sincerely, this is one of my favorite radio shows that we ever do, only because I get a chance to meet some really cool people, very knowledgeable, lots of experiences, differences of opinions, of views, and it's really kind of neat because we have a really special guest on our radio show. As usual, we have our regular guest, and then somebody else popped in that is going to be a special guest as well, and his name is Kevin Grimes, but we're going to get to the intros in just a little bit early, So, we started this as a result of myself and Doris Wood, talking about things that were going on with the MLMIA, things that are happening in the industry, and my frustration for no one's really talking about this stuff. Some of you know my previous background was with the Distributor Rights Association, then it became the ANMP, and then after me on the ANMP, it really became a seminar business, and no one was ever willing to really talk about the things that are out there. And I said, well, that's one of the reasons why we're going to do Building Fortunes Radio. So on Building Fortunes Radio, we have a chance to, like on the MLM After Hours segment, talk about some of the things that are happening in our industry that I think if you're a distributor and you're trying to really make a go of this, or a company owner making a go of this, or a vendor trying to make a go of this, you really need to have a feeling or an understanding about some of the things that are going on, because I think there's been a lot of changes, a lot of rumblings, a lot of things are really coming to a head, and it started a couple of years ago, and it's still kind of boiling over right now, and it went from, you know, the stuff that happened with Zeek Rewards and then Telex Free, and then also into stuff like what's going on with Vima right now, what may be happening with Herbalife, and there's been a couple of really people on the other side. You know, Robert Fitzpatrick is still very actively pushing things against MLM, and some you know, college professors, and we've been kind of trying to balance some of that stuff out and having some of them on some of our other radio shows as well. But I want to introduce a really great group of people right here. We're going to talk about some of the stuff that's happening in our industry, and we'll give Kevin a chance to have a spotlight as well, because we've never had him on this MLM After Hours, so I want to give him some special time as well. But first, let's go through some introductions, then we're going to do our little disclaimer. So for those people unfamiliar with my voice, even though my voice might sound tired, I'm not. My name is Peter Mingles. I run a company called PM Marketing. A lot of people know us as Network Leads, and we've kind of been all over the industry. Next, I'm going to go in the order in which they came in. So let's talk about Mel Atwood. So Mel, let's tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll get started.
So sure, Peter. Glad to be here. I've been in the space now since the mid '90s, and you know, entered more in the direct selling space, and migrated to more of the multi-level marketing profession by the late '90s, and have really held various positions throughout the industry, from being a distributor into corporate and into servicing the space, and being a consultant, providing technology. And also recently just launched a new website called MLMLegalDocs.com, where startup companies can go and get the needed legal documents for the United States. So I really kind of do a lot of different things in the space, but I love the space. I'm an advocate, and I'm very, very passionate about this industry. And so I'm glad to be here and share my thoughts.
Excellent. Next, I brought Carol Leclerc. Carol's over in Canada. She's always our international contingent, and she always shares with us some of the differences between the stuff that Canada does and the stuff that the United States does. So, Carol Leclerc, over to you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Peter. I'm delighted to be here. I look forward to this show constantly because I love the people that are on it. And, Peter, I love this subject because you're so correct. We talk about things that most other individuals and companies don't really want to talk about, but it affects the industry greatly. I'm a Canadian resident, but my heart is always half American. I've owned and operated a corporate consulting business in Canada called CLC Management for over 30 years. So we've worked with a large number of MLM companies, direct sellers who want to enter the Canadian marketplace. We work very closely with all of the compliance issues and love the industry. You know, we those of us on this call, I think they would call us lifers because we love so much that the industry represents. And I love that we're supporting the things that no one else wants to talk about to try to better the networking.
Excellent. So thanks, Carol. And then I'm not really sure in the order. Oh, it was Michael Linden. So, Michael, thanks for being next.
Hey, thank you. Good evening, everybody. Those of you who've heard me before know that I, too, am a passionate advocate of network marketing. I've been around this fascinating industry for, nearly 45 years now, and it never really ceases to amaze and delight me. It amazes me because every now and then some just totally outrageous rogues pop up, and it delights me because there are lots of really good companies out there that provide a fair shake for their distributors. I've built networks on three continents, in Africa, in Asia, Europe, and in North America. And I now focus on creating training tools for network marketers. And as I said, I'm really glad to be here tonight, and welcome to the call.
Excellent. Okay, and then I'm going to go to Len Clements. So, Len?
Well, thanks, Peter. Yeah, I've been involved in the business for 26 years now, and 10 of them as a successful distributor. Well, 9 of those 10 years I was successful, and first one wasn't so hot. But and in the last several years, pretty much full-time just as a consultant and mostly just doing expert witness jobs. I just signed on my 6th active expert witness client today because I'm a masochist and having a life. So that's what I'm going to be doing 23 hours a day for the next month. That's what I do. And you can go to my website and see things I reported on over a year ago, back when I had time to keep it updated at insidenm.com. But after the new year, I've got plans. It's going to get really active again because I got a lot of things to say and I'm tired of not being able to say them. So.
That's right. So Len is his website again is insidenm.com, but he's OCD on MLM. I think would be a really great way to talk about Len because he is really on top of a lot of things, does a lot of work, a whole bunch of stuff that he doesn't get paid for that we all benefit from this industry. So, Len, a lot of people have learned a lot of things from insidenm.com. Look forward to having you being able to post more stuff over there. Next, I think, Dr. Rowland showed up. So, Dr. Rowland?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, Peter, and it's a pleasure to be with you all tonight. I have been fortunate to be a part of this industry for about 18 years, and I started off as a distributor, and that's how I was introduced to the industry. And I was a 19-year-old kid. I was hungry. I wanted it bad. I wanted what the industry had to offer. And I didn't even know what it had to offer. I just believed that, and I was told by my sponsor that if I wanted to influence people, if I wanted to help people and be rewarded for it, then this was the place to do it. And I was I believed them. And it's been one of the best things that happened to me. I grew a lot personally. It helped me tremendously, even in corporate America, and then have been a CEO in the industry since about 2010. So I love the industry, passionate advocate of entrepreneurship, period. And I think our business model, done right, is one of the best entrepreneurial vehicles for the masses today.
Agreed, totally. And then I'm going to go a little bit out of order, even though Kevin Grimes was here. before Doris would, I'm going to let Doris introduce Kevin after Doris introduces herself. So, Doris, over to you.
Good deal. I love that. I'm Doris Wood, and anybody that wants to know, because I've been in the industry for, let's say, just over 50 years, not just over 50 years. We don't talk about all the other times, and love it. Everybody knows that I believe that MLM means making life meaningful, and am pleased to call it multi-level marketing. I have held every position that this industry has ever offered and have won every award that the industry has ever offered, from being a newest distributor to chairman of the board. And I really do love, but my biggest joy in this is the people that are on this show. I am familiar with all of them, and it is really with a great pleasure that Peter and I help pick all of them because of their intellect, because of their love for the industry, and the other things that they have brought to the show. And I am really, really pleased. Many of you know that we try to have different people come on the show, and there's always some reason that they cannot. So I am really, really pleased. And so that I don't miss anything, Kevin Grimes has been an attorney for probably, to my recollection, over 20 years that I know of. He was a distributor prior to that and built a large organization as a distributor, and that's why, in my opinion, he is one of the best attorneys in this industry and that it's ever produced. He has been a member of MLMIA since he first knew about us, and has been a speaker and led our panels on distributors for many times. There's just so much, and we could go on and fill up this whole time with talking about Kevin. So I'm going to just say it's really my pleasure to introduce you all to Kevin Grimes that don't know him. And Kevin, you tell them the things that you're most proud of.
Well, thank you, Doris. You know, it's an honor that, I mean, I'm delighted that I know most of the folks who are on the show, and I know most of them well, and for those who I don't know well, look forward to changing that. Yeah, like you said, I've been in the industry on the attorney side for 23 years, been practicing law, despite my incredibly youthful appearance, been practicing law for a mere 30 years.
Wow.
And you're absolutely right. My introduction to the industry was on the distributor side, first with Nikin and then with Amway. And there's no question that having been a distributor, I think, gives anybody a tremendous amount of circumspection about this business that you simply don't get if you only work on the corporate side. I think I'm closing in on, you know, having worked with close to 1,000, you know, direct selling and network marketing companies over my career, from startups to, you know, some of the biggest names out there. So it's a delight to be here with all of you.
Excellent. We're going to get started. We're going to play our little disclaimer. We'll be right there.
The MLM After Hours radio segment on Building Fortunes Radio is protected by local and international copyright laws. No portion or variation of this show can be duplicated, modified, or reproduced in any format without the express written consent of all parties participating on the MLM After Hours show. More information is available on www.buildingfortunesradio.com. MLM After Hours can provide the helpful information you may use to succeed in the home-based business industry. The entire content of this show consists of the research and experience, the opinions and the views of the callers, guests, and the hosts on this show. It does not constitute legal advice or specific counsel for you, as each individual should always seek individual guidance and counsel for matters related to themselves specifically.
Okay, so we're going to get started. For those people unfamiliar with my voice, again, this is Peter Mingles. We're going to kick this off with a couple of topics, and anybody can jump in and give us their opinion. There's been a few things that have happened recently that are certainly worth noting, and they're still going on. It's kind of like we're watching history as it's being made. And we started over several weeks ago. We're going to cover a couple of topics today, but there's been a lot of movement, it seems, in all different directions relative to our industry of MLM, direct sales, internet marketing, all those types of things. And one of them, of course, was the ex parte hearing and shutdown of VEMA with the FTC. And that started in August, and then we've kind of had the opportunity to be able to handle, you know, like week by week or every other week of what's actually been going on with VEMA. And it seems like things have kind of settled out but hit a little bit of a stalemate, if you will, that VEMA was allowed to open up their doors again, but they've hit a stumbling block or an impasse relative to the okay of their compensation plan being approved for their marketing. So who wants to give us, if you will, a 3 or 4 minute synopsis of what happened with VEMA and where we are today so we can talk about what's going on, for just in case some of those people that might be joining us that might not be familiar with the FTC and the VEMA action. So does somebody want to jump in and give us a 2 or 3 minute or 3 or 4 minute synopsis on VEMA so far to bring us up to today?
I'd like to nominate Len.
Len, it's your turn.
Yeah, nominate the guy that takes the longest and uses the most words to explain something in 2 or 3 minutes.
We're picking on you, Len.
Well,
you
that way we know we can always come back and listen again, because if it takes you that long to explain, then we know we can be entertained again.
Okay, well,
Len, hold on. Let me say, you can omit the part where you were wrong, okay? So I'm going to give you permission. I'll give you permission.
Yeah, but the one distributor that I thought would be loyal to them that took a corporate position, okay? But
that's right.
So yeah, VEMA was going along just fine by 11-year-old company doing $200 million a year, and then they got ambushed by a home office raid after they after the FEC and the judge had an ex parte hearing, which means VEMA wasn't even aware the hearing was taking place, let alone there to defend themselves. They were put under receivership, and the assets were frozen, and it was shut down for 26 days. Then they had a hearing where they had 16 days to basically put up an entire defense that normally would have taken probably a month or years, and with frozen assets, and ended up essentially going from the gallows to probation with an ankle bracelet. Because the FEC wanted them dead, and instead they got the receiver removed. The assets were unfrozen. They're still under an injunction with a monitor in place that was assigned. Of course, the monitor is the same as the receiver who was trying to kill the company, but that's the monitor now that everything has to go through to make sure that they abide by the injunction. So even though they're technically back in business and they're shipping product, they pretty much can't get practically anything approved now because the people that essentially want them dead were put in charge of approving everything. So that's what they're struggling with right now. So that was a slightly biased version, but still accurate.
There we go. And Len, you had mentioned when you were doing your thing, one of the things that you said that probably are one of the issues that tripped them up is they were claiming they had 70% like customers, and you know, they were really staking their whole thing on like most of our businesses by customers, and 70% was a number that they kind of really built something upon. That got them away from the noose on the hanging, but then the ankle bracelet, using your term, was when the judge basically said, well, if 70% is the number, how about you get 50% customers and we'll let you reopen up again if you can design a compensation plan with 50% customers. Is that more or less where we are at the sticking points right now based on my words and your opinion?
Yeah, the original order of the judge said that the majority of compensation, and this is going to be very key, the majority of compensation be derived from sales to outside customers, not to other affiliates. And now the FTC continues to say that that was based on a majority of volume, and they want everything to be based on volume. So kind of jumping ahead here to what just happened recently with them trying to get their new compensation plan approved, but for some reason, apparently the judge has forgotten that he said the majority of compensation, and now is agreeing with the FTC that it should be the majority of volume. But ultimately, they did have to, for example, you can't personally buy the product now to qualify for your own qualifications. And, you know, there's other kind of restrictions like that. There's no more $600 packs that you can buy up front and things like that. But which again, by the way, if someone's going to take the business serious and they buy a lot of training material and sales aids and inventory up front because they actually want to sell it, so by disallowing them to do that actually harms their chances of success in the business if they want to do it legitimately. But that's one of the what I call unintended consequences that people who don't know anything about MLM end up inadvertently doing when they try to create compensation plans and rules for MLM companies when they don't understand the space. But there's a long list of these kind of unintended consequences that we can get into about what they're doing and what the repercussions would be and how professional comp plan designers, for example, would have recognized these things and maybe help the FTC and the judge kind of, you know, avoid all these minefields. But instead, they're essentially recommending that VEMA do things that potentially and very likely will be more harmful and create completely the wrong incentives and motivations that they're intending to do because they just simply don't understand the space. But that was just one example. But yeah, there are these injunctions that they've got to operate under, pretty strict restrictions about basically who buys the product and who gets compensated and whose volume qualifies as far as being eligible for commissions.
There we go. Okay, so there's a little bit of backdrop. We don't have Kevin Grimes on the radio show often, and I know sometimes lawyers or attorneys have certain things they're not allowed to talk about. So, Kevin, are you allowed to give us any kind of your opinion or anything on what's happened with VEMA and some of the things that the industry has to watch out for?
Yeah, I can definitely talk about, you know, kind of things from the 35,000-foot perspective and certainly, you know, things that are relative to the industry overall.
Okay, so give a whack at it. Whatever part you want to jump in on, we're all ears.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, I certainly agree with a lot of Len's comments. You know, something that I think those of us in the industry often maybe aren't mindful of is the fact that, you know, this is a federal judge. This is not somebody who is an expert on MLM law. I'm sure this is probably the first time he's ever seen anything remotely close to it. And, you know, to think that we, you know, are going to get particularly erudite, you know, decisions, you know, certainly we hope they'll comport with the law. But, you know, again, to think that we're going to get a lot of analysis, especially in a situation like this where you've got, you know, a TRO situation where things have to happen very, very, very quickly. You know, the court, you know, has to balance just time constraints with, you know, hopefully rendering a just decision. So, again, it really is kind of a Salamic or, you know, Solomon type situation. You know, its most recent order that it cranked out last Thursday regarding the compensation plan, which it denied VEMA's motion for approval of the compensation plan, is interesting. You know, when I read it the first time, I mean, it's only three and a half pages long, really about three pages of text. And you get through the first couple of pages, and it's just like, I'm not sure that I understand where the court is coming from. It's certainly very clear that it relied or was persuaded a lot by the FTC's position, and particularly the FTC's expert witness, I believe, Dr. Bosley. But the bottom line is, you know, the court concluded, hey, this, you know, VEMA's proposed changes or, you know, revised compensation plan just doesn't get the job done, doesn't go far enough to incentivize sales to customers. And it's interesting that, you know, that issue has raised its head. I think, you know, one of the weaknesses of the proposed compensation plan was, you know, who's what, you know, who's a distributor, who's a customer. The court cited, and Dr. Bosley teed off on the definitions as, you know, a distributor or participant as being defined as one who intends to participate and earn rewards under VEMA's marketing plan. And a customer is defined as someone who's interested in purchasing and using VEMA products. If that's the extent of the definitions, I think those definitions are very, very weak. I don't think those definitions did VEMA any favors. You know, we've got language from the Burn Lounge case, the Ninth Circuit's opinion last year, as well as the infamous, you know, Webster versus Omnitrition decision, and they definitely speak in terms of having two absolutely discrete categories of players. You know, participants, you know, irrespective of whether you call them distributors, affiliates, associates, whatever, on the one hand, and customers on the other hand, and there is no overlap. You know, my concern, again, just given these definitions, is that, you know, who's a distributor and who's a customer is a proverbial moving target. I think that's certainly problematic. Also, it seems like that, you know, well, it was interesting, too, because on the last page and in its conclusion, the court made a comment that the FTC suggested that the court require VEMA to pay compensation only to an affiliate whose entire organization's sales to customers were at least 51% of the total sales for the organization. Well, and again, something I think that's been true since the Omnitrition decision, something that I've been, you know, maybe a little preachy about, is what I consider to be the biggest secret in MLM, and you know, everybody might want to lean in closely to hear this, and that is customers are good for business. And again, you know, in my universe, in the regulatory universe, when I use that term, I mean a term that's mutually exclusive with being a distributor. We love distributors. It's just that we love customers more. And then, you know, and the Omnitrition Court talked about that, you know, I mean, I think Omnitrition was very, very poorly reasoned in a lot of ways, but it is what it is. And, you know, the court said that, you know, in our opinion, a multi-level compensation plan inherently rewards distributor recruiting. When you translate that, what the court is saying is a multi-level compensation plan is inherently a pyramid. That's what that particular court was saying. So it went on to say the only way to legitimize one, in our opinion, is by tying the distributor's receipt of compensation to sales to customers. And that's arguably, you know, certainly what VEMA attempted to do. But again, in the opinion of Judge Tucci, it didn't go far enough. Well, so, you know, where does that leave the industry? Well, he talks about Amway, and, you know, everybody on this call certainly knows what the Amway safeguards or safe harbors are. Does that mean that we're back to Amway? Does that mean that, you know, even if a company has 51% of its sales coming from customers, that may not be enough to save it from, you know, some type of a regulatory enforcement action? Good question. But the court also, you know, commented that that the revised compensation plan simply did not do enough or go far enough with respect to preventing, you know, the mother of all evils, namely bonus buying and inventory loading. And so, you know, how can we do that? I think we have to do that by materially and significantly incentivizing sales to customers. And, you know, in my opinion, there are very, very, very few compensation plans that do that.
Okay, so what do you think about the challenges that VEMA is going to have moving forward with trying to get a compensation plan to stick? Or is this just one of those things where they're going to try to drag it out, and by the time they're done, maybe there's no more VEMA?
Well, I think they've been making some moves in the right direction. I mean, I certainly you know, haven't been following every move that the company has been making. I know, or at least I'm of the understanding, and Lynn or Mel can certainly correct me if I'm mistaken, that VEMA lowered its prices on its products. I think that's a fantastic move because, you know, the bottom line is real customers are only going to purchase products for one reason, namely their intrinsic value. If the value is poor, they're not going to buy. Obviously, you know, when a company lowers its product, the price, you know, to the extent that the, you know, benefits and quality of the product remains the same, the value increases. So, you know, increased product value naturally has a greater tendency to attract and retain customers. So, you know, that's certainly a move in the right direction. But again, I think, you know, tying the distributor's receipt of compensation at the individual level and also at the organizational level are going to be very, very important. And, the FTC is certainly pushing that position, and the court seems to be inclined to, you know, to move in that direction as well.
Got it. Does anybody else have any questions they want to ask Kevin about the VEMA case?
What's their next plan? What's their next plan of action for VEMA?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm, you know, not counsel to NEMA. I suspect, obviously, it's mission critical that they get a compensation plan that, that the judge is going to approve. So my suspicion is they are working fast and furious to develop a compensation plan that's going to make the judge happy. And I just, my hope is that they're getting some good counsel. They've got a great law firm in Phoenix they're working with. My hope is they've got some great counsel on the comp plan design side to help them, get over this hump with the judge.
Kevin, can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
In your opinion, I realize that in some of the documents that came out of the court, that the issues against VEMA from the FTC were stated that these issues were exclusively for VEMA,
mm-hmm.
but I have a major concern that it's going to somehow erode into many other companies out there. Are you experiencing many companies that are suddenly taking a look at what they, the plans and the programs that they've got?
Yes and no. Yes, we are seeing companies wanting folks to take a good hard look at their program to make sure they're not misstepping. I've done that for some clients and found some very, very similar components in their compensation plan and some very, very similar fact patterns. But to be candid, Carol, my concern is the vast majority of companies are not doing that.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
There just seems to be, an ostrich with its head in the sand approach to this. And while you're exactly right, we are hearing that verbiage from the FTC. The fact of the matter is, in the United States, unlike Canada, we don't have a federal anti-pyramiding statute. And so what a pyramid is defined exclusively by case law. And so federal cases absolutely, positively do impact the entire industry and every single company.
So is that what this will be?
This is a federal case, yeah. Regardless of what the outcome is, I mean, if FEMA prevails, we'll probably see the FTC appeal. If the FTC prevails, I'm sure we'll see VEMA appeal. And again, we'll get another U.S. Court of Appeals decision out there to join the ranks of Burn Lounge and Omnitrition. And again, that's all case law, which is to say it is the body of federal law regarding pyramids.
So if the ruling is that 50% or more of, what are they going to say, your volume, your compensation, your sales are
mm-hmm.
going to come from outside customers,
mm-hmm.
what percentage of the companies that are in existing today would be compliant?
Yeah. First of all, it depends how we define a customer. And, a lot of companies are touting very, very high percentages of sales to customers. But honestly, we have to drill down a little bit deeper. And I have two very large dogs. The specific breed is an Akita. If you want to call my Akitas Siamese cats, you can do so, but they will never be Siamese cats, and calling them that won't make them so. And so, in the scientific community says they're Canis familiaris. With respect to who's a customer, who's a distributor, again, we've got a ultimately, the courts and legislative bodies are kind of the ultimate arbiters of that. And I think as an industry, it's important that, that we kind of line up our definitions and our compensation plans with their realities. And so, I think it's becoming very, very clear that, who regulators and courts are going to consider to be customers and who they're going to be consider to be distributors is become – oh, go ahead, Doris.
Kevin, we know that many, many distributors join a company in order to get the product, which they happen to really like, at a
mm-hmm.
discount.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
they do not recruit. Now,
yep.
if they join the company and do not recruit, can't they be counted as customers?
Great question. You know, the FTC has addressed that, and their position is absolutely not. You know, that was an issue in the Burn Lounge case. I think that might have been an issue in the Trek Alliance case. Their position is if somebody executes, they sign a distributor agreement, we're going to count them as distributor. They've obviously evidenced their intent to be a distributor, despite the fact that factually they've never done anything.
And didn't want to.
Do, yeah. And I guess my response to that, too, would be, you know, my impression is, you know, I used to poll my clients, and, you know, and I ask, I mean, you know, what percentage of folks are actually doing something and versus the ones who aren't? And the reality in this industry is that, you know, about 70 to 80% of the people who sign up as distributors don't build business. You're exactly right. They really want to be wholesale customers. They want to purchase the product at the lowest possible price. And my response is, why do companies, shoehorn people into that category when by their behaviors they're telling us they don't want to be in that category? And when it, you know, is arguably tantamount to, you know, shooting yourself in the foot from a regulatory perspective, why don't we put them in that separate category of player called a customer? And for our best customers, like customers who are willing to pony up for an auto ship, give them the best price. Give them the distributor price, because if you don't, then I would say, you know, a company's arguably cutting the legs out from underneath its distributors with respect to customer acquisition.
You know, Kevin, that brings me around to a point that I've been saying for years, which is we need to not have a disparity of pricing. Now,
yep.
Some people, the proponents of the disparity, say, well, what about the wholesale retail thing? And so I think you make a good point here, but what I'd like to bring that around to is the fact that you can still, quote-unquote, have a retail customer paying the same price as a distributor when the company is the actual distributor. When the quote unquote distributors not buying at wholesale, turning around and selling at retail, which is what, you know, the bulk of the industry today does not have distributors per se. They have marketers or independent marketing or affiliates where they're essentially referring business to the distributor, which in most of the cases is the company. Distribution being someone who is taking a product out of a warehouse or delivering a product to an end customer. In 99%, well, I don't know if 99, it's well over 90% of the customers in direct sales and multi-level marketing today go through the company. And so I think one of the fundamental shifts we can do, and we're looking at, Carol asked the question, what's the next step? Well, evolution is the next step. We either evolve or we die. I think that the evolution, one of the biggest mechanisms here is to let go of the tradition of giving, quote-unquote, distributors. I like to call them something else. Call them affiliates. Call them what you will. They're no longer distributing, so I don't want to call them distributors. But give them, have them pay the same price as customers, and customers pay the same prices as participants or independent professionals, whatever you want to call them. But I think that is one step in the right direction so that we don't have that motive that drives people into becoming part of the business unless they really want to be a part of the business.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a one step in the right direction. I've got a lot of other steps, but I don't want to occupy a lot of the time here.
You know, one of the challenges to that is that one of the criticisms that I don't know if it's the judge or the FTC, I think it was the judge in the order, one of the criticisms against VEMA is they don't have a suggested markup that someone can make money by retailing the product.
But
so you got to convince them
then,
now.
Uh-huh.
Well, right, but that argument is because they're asking people to buy more product than they could personally consume. I think that you pair what I just said with the idea that, number one, you remove any incentive for personal purchases in the compensation plan, meaning if I buy something, it doesn't matter. If I do buy something, it doesn't matter. It doesn't give me any advantage in the comp plan. So by removing advantages in the comp plan for my personal purchases, as well as by making it so that the only purchase that I would make is whatever I would want to personally consume. And then all of a sudden, again, these big packs that VEMA was selling, that's a good criticism of VEMA in the context that they were selling $600 packs. whereby most people aren't going to buy and use $600 worth of product. So they do need a resale because the only way to get rid of that product legitimately, because you can't give it away, because then that would be a sales aid, would be then to resell it. And since there's not a markup, that's why the legitimate criticism is there. But that is not an argument against the point that I was making, because I think in the totality of the argument I'm making, there would be no big packs. People wouldn't be incentivized to buy product themselves inside the comp plan, and then all of a sudden the whole game shifts.
All right, I understand. I agree with you, and I get your point. My point was that, and in this case it was the judge, I just found it, the judge in this last order, one of the things he says that's missing is this revised retail pricing a tier that gives them an incentive for affiliates to retail to customers. So my point was is that for us to make that argument, somehow we as an industry or we've got to get a hold of this judge or these judges or the FTC and have a conversation with them to explain to them, you guys don't know what you're doing. You need someone who understands this industry and understands comp plan theory and understands motivation and reward and how it applies to this industry, because right now this judge in this case is saying, Vima, you got to mark up your product. You got to stop doing what Mel thinks you should do that you were already doing, which is a pretty good idea, and you've got to do it the less efficient way. And not only that, but this is what I mean by unintended consequences, which I guarantee you nobody in the FTC probably in their history has ever thought of. But if you have a retail markup, whatever that is, let's say it's a $10 product, you mark it up to $14 retail. Most distributors, because they love their product, are going to buy it to personally consume. So you have to charge them sales tax based on the suggested retail price because you have to assume they're selling it at retail. Otherwise, all the distributors have to pay their own retail sales tax if they do sell it at retail, if they only got charged on the wholesale price they bought it for. So every MLM company, if they have a wholesale retail pricing, charges their distributor sales tax at retail. So if the large majority of them are in fact personally consuming because they love the product and the company adds a retail markup to it, you're not doing your distributors any favor. All you're doing is making your distributors pay more sales tax that they otherwise wouldn't have had to pay. And the greater retail opportunity you give them, the greater retail markup or greater incentive to retail that this judge is telling Vima you got to put in here, the more it's going to cost distributors who are just personally consuming. So I guarantee you they didn't consider that.
I would still argue, though, that in the context of what they're talking about here, that judge is still in that mindset of Vima was charging these big amounts of money to get in, and so he's still reeling from that. I don't think that taken in context with what are the greater standards for the industry, that the idea that a markup or a retail price is necessary, or if that were the case, you're going to have some very interesting implications relative to affiliate programs as well.
You know what?
If you get the revised order, because it's out there, look at the end of page 3. That's in context. And the context is all the things Vima's plan is missing that incentivizes retailing that the judge wanted to see.
Yeah, I understand. I've read it. But
you know what? If you don't put in a suggested retail price, then there are some distributors who are going to sell it way, way over what they should.
One thing
and
they got
others
for
that are probably going
to
give
so
it away, which will then,
for.
You know, so there's got to be a price of the value of it.
But that,
you know,
assumes, though, Doris, the assumption you're making, though, is that the business model includes a resale component. And my argument is that in today's MLM model, that just doesn't exist. People do not resell product by and far. And if we would eliminate
let's ask
we do ourselves
the only
a great justice.
Corporate that's on here, Roland, do our distributors, and we've got a distributor on here, how much of the product are you selling, Michael, and how much are your at a different company? Roland, how would you address that? Are your distributors selling product?
Yeah,
well, I'm afraid
question.
That I'm
ahead,
very
Michael.
Distributor heavy. Hello?
Yes. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, that was it. I'm just, I can't answer the question. My networks now are I'm very, very heavy at the top with distributors. They're most of my networking now is with older groups that have matured and they've stayed with it simply because they like the product so much, and they become distributors along the way. So I don't know that I can answer your question very clearly.
Well, Doris, I appreciate the question, and our perspective, my perspective as leading a company is that, and I want us to be the a white hat and really innovate and pioneer the way the industry needs to be. But we have one segment of our group that is very much into reselling the product. I mean, they prefer to only retail products. What I can tell you, especially from after being the president CEO of another company, that was very unusual. In fact, usually what people did, the only people who did had an outlet for that in the past was at trade shows. And, of course, that's one of the worst ways to build a direct sales business, or a network marketing business, that is. But it has always been a good way if you were in jewelry or if you're in certain party plan or, you know, things of that nature where you are doing actual retail selling. So we do have a segment that is doing that. But I agree with the statement that, by and large, the vast majority of the industry does not do that. If you look at Amway, their people are not buying the products at wholesale and then going out and reselling everything at retail. It's just not the model. But then you can look at other smaller organizations or even some of the newer, hottest companies that may be jewelry or do-it-yourself type party plan, party products. Those are more centric to buying the products, having the inventory, and then the customers at the plans kind of deciding, what they want to do with it. I think that the It Works business model is very interesting as well, because it is kind of a hybrid of these two. People pay to pretty much go to a party because they're buying their wrap, their sample. They're buying that sample. So they're charging the prospect, or if you want to call it a customer, but you're charging them for the ability to show them that it works so that you can sell them on either becoming a distributor or selling them on more packages. So to me, that's very similar to a hybrid. I really want to see us as an industry, and I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all, but I agree with Kevin that the premise has to be that we have to allow for buying at wholesale and selling at retail because that is a traditional business model that federal judges do understand. You do not have to convince them or educate them that Walmart buys their products at a cheaper price than what they sell them for. What you do have to convince people of is, the other thing that you do not have to is Microsoft and HP and BMC and these other technology companies and organizations that have resellers. The way a lot of the telecommunications and technology companies, their reselling programs, they offer between 5, 10, 20% after you have referred their products and services, which you do not have to purchase. But a lot of times what comes with that, and every company is different on this front, but you have to commit to a certain amount of volume. HP, for example, you have to commit to doing a certain amount of volume, let's just say $200,000 a year. And if I don't resell $200,000 of HP offerings, then I have to pay the difference. So it forces activity. They never force me to buy my product. That's a penalty. So a lot of it is how it is structured. And I really believe that we can learn a lot from how traditional business has operated and then use a lot of that same leverage and terminology so that it's more consistent instead of coming up with our own.
So,
Roland,
Doris,
I agree with I agree with what you're saying, and I agree with Mel and Len on their various points. However, one of the big concerns that I think is always a flag in the industry, and it has grown drastically in the last 4 to 5 years, is selling these big packs. In my mind, anything over maybe $400 in a pack is front-end loading, because if Mel's right and people aren't retailing, why do you have to buy $600 or $2,500 in a pack? That is just to qualify to get you to the next level. You know, if we can order product from 99.9% of these companies 24/7 over the internet, and that product can be delivered very rapidly to you, why do we have to order $2,500 worth of product at one point if they're not retailing it? People are buying into a position, and I think that's a big flag that causes a lot of concern in the industry, and I don't think it's
healthy.
I don't think it's appropriate. Kevin, what do you think about this?
Well, I would absolutely agree. You know, I mean, if the Federal Trade Commission had a problem with Burn Lounge, their most expensive package was $425. It's not surprising they'd have a problem with a $600 package. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, I mean, there are a lot of things that are industry-wide issues that the industry needs to take a good hard look at. You know, Carol, you asked this question. You know, why would companies do that? And the answer is, I call it MLM cocaine. Fast start bonuses often, not always, but often are just a form of MLM cocaine. And there's a lot of old thinking, old paradigms that need to change. You know, kind of wanted to go back to Mel's point about just, you know, the realities of the industry and selling to customers and how that, you know, jives with Len's point. We need to be selling products to customers. We need to develop definitions of customers that are regulatorily viable. And again, that is not these moving target customers like, well, you know, even though you signed a distributor agreement, you're a customer unless and until you satisfy these 27 different factors and all the planets line up. It's like, no, they need to be absolutely separate, discrete, and the twain never meet. Secondly, compensation plans need to be radically redesigned. One of my favorite questions to ask entrepreneurs after I reviewed their comp plan is, you know, tell me exactly what your objectives behind the design of this plan were. And normally what comes back is this deer in the headlights, we want to reward the people who do the work. And I submit there are very, very specific objectives that should be met by a well-designed comp plan, but the first and the foremost objective is to incentivize and reward product sales to customers and customer acquisition. And I challenge anybody on this call to name 3 MLM compensation plans, not involving party plan companies, that materially and significantly incentivize, you know, product sales to customer and customer acquisition. You know, every company, you know, every entrepreneur and executive will say, well, we have a retail commission. It's like, that's de minimis compensation. That's not material and significant. When I say material and significant, I mean that, you know, by a distributor going out and developing these minimally adequate customer bases with sufficient customer sales, that they're doubling and tripling their compensation. Now, that's material and significant, but they're really
aren't. I agree with you, but let me tell you what I would like to see, because as from a CEO perspective on it, it is difficult, and I haven't been able to find it. As a senior executive, an owner that was willing to do, no matter how much I'm fighting in the boardroom, that has the stomach or the appetite to do that. And part of it's because that is the long game, not the short game. And,
yep.
And which is what the one we should be playing. We should be playing the long game. And what happens is it requires a new breed of direct seller. It requires a new breed of network marketer. We have to raise up our own crop. If people are, if the company owners are former distributors and they're trying to get a lot of the people who have been distributors in other companies, they're bringing to the table a way of doing it, and they're evaluating comp plan based on, you know, those premonitions that they're bringing with them. which are going to be inaccurate in any legitimate current network marketer would look at it and say, yeah, I can't make money with this plan, next. So it literally requires an owner with that long-term thinking and saying, look, this is going to be a long road. I'm actually having to pioneer a new industry because nobody's going to understand this comp plan